On this week's Section D, 14 years after Concorde's final flight, we ask, is a new era of supersonic flight waiting in the wings? That and a few more interesting directions being taken in the travel industry today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan, standing in this week for Josh Fennett. Also today...
Lugging the 23-kilogram moustache up and down a narrow staircase feels like coaxing a sleepy bull into a birdcage.
As e-bike sales gather pace in Europe, Monocle's business editor takes one for a test drive to see how the hardware stands up here in London. Plus...
The body has to clothe it as economically and as aerodynamically as possible. And to a great extent, that helps to make the beauty that you see.
A new exhibition will open the chassis on the history of a brand that's done more than most to put Italian engineering at the head of the pack, Ferrari. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Concorde was the preferred means of travel for A-listers, politicians and royalty from the late 60s until it ceased to fly in 2003. With a flight time of 3.5 hours from New York to London, musician Phil Collins famously attended 2 Live Aid concerts on the same day, flying supersonically from London to Philadelphia. The supersonic jet's 27 years of service ushered in a new era of glamour in travel that looked set to stay. But a string of design and technical challenges grounded it for good. Now, a handful of entrepreneurs are planning to break the sound barrier once again in commercial flight. We'll meet the intrepid souls a little later, but first, here's Monocle's own transport correspondent, Tristan McAllister, to explain why Concorde was grounded in the first place and how a new era of supersonic passenger jets may yet get off the ground.
Dallas, approach Beeper Concorde 189 Heavy at 10,000.
Beeper Concorde 189 Heavy, all approach December 8th.
In 1976, Concorde made its first commercial flight, and it did so with a bang. Literally. Not only did it fly at nearly 2 times the speed of sound, but the design of its engines and airframe meant that it created a shockwave as it ripped through the sky and made many times more noise than a jetliner of that era. This was a problem, and while Concorde became the talk of the aviation world, it also became the subject of fierce political debate. Governments were concerned. The jet was too loud to be flown over populated areas. They argued it put people's health at risk, and to be fair, cows grazing in fields were actually losing their hearing when the jet flew over. Legislation was soon passed around the globe. Concorde was banned from flying at full speed over many populated areas, relegated to parts of the world where its sonic boom wasn't hurting anyone. Fortunately, there was a route upon which that wasn't an issue, over the vast open ocean of the North Atlantic. Actually, the New York to London service on Concorde became a highly sought-after experience. But maintenance and fuel costs and rapid advances in cabin design, i.e. lie-flat seats, would eventually put an end to the Concorde's life. Why get to London in 3.5 hours when you could do it in 6 and sleep, and for a fraction of the ticket price?
Puff of smoke.
In 2003, the last commercial flight with the jet landed in London, thus bringing an era to a close. While a few of the jets are mothballed around the world, it's highly unlikely any airline will ever bring them back. What endures, however, is its design legacy. Concorde, built through a partnership between the British and the French, has a unique delta wing design. This means that the length of the wings literally runs from nearly the nose to the tail of the jet. It looks in some ways, from above, like a flying triangle. Today, a few startups are loosely mimicking that design. They're also looking for ways to make it so the design actually reduces the amount of boom a supersonic jet creates. Noise, not fuel efficiency, or really any other barrier, is one of the biggest factors that keeps supersonic flight from becoming the standard in commercial aviation. And governments won't change the noise mandates anytime soon.
We're here today to talk about NASA's work to make flight cleaner, greener, safer, and quieter. all while developing aircraft that travel faster and building an aviation system that operates more efficiently.
Still, a U.S. government agency may be the one that actually solves the noise problem. NASA says it will test an eardrum-friendly supersonic prototype by 2022. That said, there are companies who are close to what they say is a viable, significantly more efficient supersonic passenger transport jet, and they aren't concerned with the noise so much and expect that their first jets will be plenty useful on routes over unpopulated areas.
So we are working on our first prototype airplane now.
It's going to go from Europe to Australia in about 4 hours, 4.5 hours.
Supersonic travel for both cargo and humans will result in many exciting and efficient benefits.
In the future, they think there's plenty of demand for something such as an all-business class service on a 5-hour and 45-minute flight from London to Cape Town, or a 6-hour and 30-minute flight from Singapore to London. Sir Richard Branson has even said he'll be the first to buy a few of these jets, which surprises absolutely no one. For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
Thanks, Tristan. Concorde was a child of post-war Europe, a collaboration between aircraft manufacturing giants the British Aircraft Corporation and France's Aérospatiale, both now defunct. Others certainly tried to join the supersonic flight race, but failed. Russia's version, nicknamed Concordsky, was scrapped following a series of accidents after just 55 passenger flights. But the next wave of supersonic travel, if it comes, will almost certainly come from the US. Daphne Karnisis spoke to some hopeful successors. She started by asking the co-founder of Nevada-based Aerion Corporation, Brian Barrent, how the company's supersonic jet compares and differs from Concorde.
We are looking at a time savings of almost 4 hours on a one-way trip between the U.S. and Western Europe. Typical configuration will be 12 passengers. That can be expanded up to 18, but we think it'll be a typical 12-passenger configuration with a range of 5,200 nautical miles subsonically and 4,600 nautical miles supersonically. So it has adequate range from North America to anywhere in Europe and from the west coast of the United States to Asia. This airplane is being designed to be used for business applications and high net worth individuals and some government applications. We don't anticipate that the first airplane, which is the AS-2, will be used for commercial applications.
Do you see that happening a few years down the line, or?
Well, all of our technology is scalable. That means it can be used in a larger airplane, but our first application is going to be for the business jet, and at some later date, if we see the demand for a commercial airplane, we will certainly be in a position to accommodate that need.
And obviously, as part of your design process, to what extent did you study and use the template of the Concorde to develop your current sort of incarnation of it?
Well, really nothing. The Concorde is a 30-year-old design. So much has changed since that time, not only in the materials that are available, but production or construction techniques. So there really wasn't really any similarity between our design and the Concorde. The airplane utilizes all new technology that wasn't available during the development of the Concorde. It has a propulsion system that is much quieter and much more efficient than what the Concorde had. It will meet most of the environmental requirements, and it does so very efficiently. And that's due in large part to the patented process that we enjoy at Aerion with what we call the natural laminar flow wing that provides us with high efficiency at both high subsonic speeds as well as supersonic speeds.
I believe there are a few players and a few other companies also developing supersonic airplanes based on supersonic travel. What would you say your unique selling point is?
Well, we have been at this for almost 14 years, and we've learned a lot during that period of time. And we believe that we have a first mover advantage. The biggest obstacle for us was the propulsion system that would provide the performance that we were looking for, as well as meeting the regulatory requirements, primarily for takeoff noise, not so much the boom scenario. And we know all of the engines that are available out there, and it leads us to be somewhat skeptical with regard to some of the claims that one or two of the other participants are making. We invite their participation. It brings attention to the supersonic segment, and we welcome the competition.
That was Brian Barents, the co-founder of Nevada-based Aerion Corporation. I also spoke to Boston-based Spike Aerospace, who are changing the aesthetics of their planes, which for them also means no windows. Here's what Spike's CEO, Vic Acoria, told me.
The Concorde was an absolutely amazing aircraft, well ahead of its time, designed in the 1960s and really changed aviation. Unfortunately, it was designed so long ago when fuel was different, when the markets were different. Technology just... It has certainly been developed since then, and that's what we're taking advantage of. We learned a lot from what the Concorde did and what customers wanted. We were applying all the new technologies that have become available in the last 50 years, including composite materials and new engines, engineering techniques, and software to design aircraft. We're able to design an aircraft that will be much, much more efficient, much quieter, so you won't have the sonic boom. It'll fly over land from Europe to Middle East to Asia without disturbing people on the ground. That was one limitation that the Concorde had. Mm-hmm. Another innovation that we have in this aircraft is what we call the multiplex digital cabin. That's where the passenger compartment, there's no windows. There's none of those small porthole windows. We replaced all of that with a large full-length digital screen that goes from one side of the cabin to the other. With cameras all around the aircraft, you can see everything that's going outside, like a landscape view. It's going to be absolutely brilliant, really, really sharp images to see the world as you fly by it. Or you can watch movies, PowerPoint presentations. You can have a night sky view, anything you want to do. It's pretty amazing.
So you're based in Boston. I know there are quite a few companies, your competitors, based on the West Coast. Tell me about how being in Boston has helped you.
Every location has its advantages and drawbacks, and I love Boston. I've been here for many years. It has an incredible academic community, people doing the latest advanced research. It's also very close to Europe and the Middle East, makes traveling to those regions much easier. There's a great workforce here also. So I love being in the area. I think it has a lot to offer.
And there's been a lot of talk about how, at least in the beginning, tickets will be aimed more towards high-end, high-net-worth individuals. Are affordable tickets still a long way away?
That depends partially on airlines and the perception of what an expensive ticket are. It may not be economy-class seats, but you certainly can have business fares that will be around the business-class ticket pricing. So tickets from London to New York are typically around $5,000 for business class. And a lot of people are able to fly that. They're not high net worth individuals, but they're flying on behalf of their companies. So companies can certainly justify that expense to get their employees to destinations in half the time. Mm-hmm. One of the advantages of this flight is you don't have to spend overnight. If you're flying from London to New York, you can fly early in the morning, arrive in New York, do your business and fly back and be home in time for dinner. But the advantage also is that you don't have to spend a night in New York. So for a company, there's huge expense in meals and hotel and transportation locally. And you miss, by being able to fly back, you get to have dinner with your family again.
And just finally, can you give me some examples of cuts to the duration of specific routes? I mean, which ones are people usually most impressed by?
The one I love talking about, New York to London is 3 hours. Instead of 6 or 7 hours. One thing to keep in mind, so when you're flying supersonic on a supersonic business jet, you're typically not flying out of Heathrow or JFK. You're going to a smaller executive airport, and their security lines are much, much shorter. You typically just walk onto the plane. So you're on the plane within 20 minutes. You fly, when you land in the other country, you go through a special immigration desk, which flights are much, much shorter also. So that 2 hour time that you need to for customs and security, you really don't need as much on a business jet. So flights are typically New York, London that we all talk about, or New York to Paris, cut in half. But it's a longer routes like New York to Dubai that people are interested in, or London to Hong Kong. Those are typically 12-hour flights currently, and we can cut them down to 6 hours.
That's amazing.
That's fantastic. It is. Yeah, and I think the value when you think about it is really the relationships that you can build. If you're only flying there once a year, you know, it's nice to save the time, but it's for businesses that need to build relationships, and you do that by getting in front of somebody else and shaking hands and having dinner with them and having a casual conversation. So that's how you build relationships in business, right? It's people you get to know over time. A 12-hour flight is very difficult to do. You can watch 4 movies and read for 4 hours, and you still got time to kill. But if you fly there in 6 hours, you can probably do that every month.
Yeah.
You know, it's very comfortable.
That was Spike Aerospace CEO Vic Kokoria speaking to Daphne Karnizes. Now, the headlines we're watching in the fast-moving world of transport. Surprised that Norway's dark winters had not inspired more innovative street lighting, Kristin Bredel, an award-winning theatre light designer, set up Zenisk, specialising in urban lighting design. Now the firm has created the lighting system for Loren Station in Oslo, which highlights the building's pleasing architecture while making it safe for pedestrians. Next to Brisbane, where in 2011 floodwaters ravaged the city, causing some $300 billion of damage. A third of the city's public ferry terminals were lost, crippling a zippy service used by commuters and tourists. An international design competition was promptly held to determine the architectural opportunities posed by the need to replace the terminals. It was won by Australia's Cox Architecture and Oricon, an engineering company. Sleek black and orange piers are visible even on rainy days, while the terminal shape, streamlined like a boat hull, reduced the chance of dangerous debris getting lodged in them. The smartest aspect of the 8 new structures is a detachable system that allows the gangway and main pontoon to unlatch and float away during extremely high torrents, reducing potential damage. A high watermark of design if ever we've seen one. The Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Ryland. He's on br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Stay tuned. City planners' love of Danish-style cycle-friendly lanes have already made life easier for cyclists all over the world. But it seems that many of them are still looking for a bit more oomph behind the pedals to make their journey that little bit smoother. Sales of pushbikes have actually fallen 8% over the past decade to last year, but over the same period, e-bike sales have shot up tenfold. It's still the case that roughly one is sold for every 10 traditional ones, but that said, these battery-powered options are now responsible for most of the growth in the bike market. For those of you who don't know what to expect from owning such a vehicle, Monocle's own Matt Alagaya took to the saddle himself for a test ride.
Day one. I pick up my bike from the helpful team at Fully Charged, London's leading shop for e-bike rentals. They have folding models and good-looking Kobox, but they start me off on a bulky model from French brand Moustache. Apparently, it's a good one for beginners. They've got the measure of me already. Although it has 4 modes, ranging from Eco to Turbo, I keep it in the tamest setting for the first ride back to the Monocle office. It takes no time to get used to the gentle assistance from the Bosch motor and the effortless ride. Heading over Blackfriars Bridge on Cycle Superhighway 6, I reach 17 kilometers an hour with ease, which feels like a decent clip. Day 2. Living on the second floor is an issue, as lugging the 23 kilogram Moustache up and down a narrow staircase feels like coaxing a sleepy bull into a birdcage. Nonetheless, with the battery fully charged overnight, once on the road the bike feels light as air. On the way into Midori House, I brave the next 2 modes, Tour and Sport, and zoom up hills and down empty roads, a rarity with London traffic. There's a hairy moment that evening when I start pedalling too hard before I've really got control of the bike and am propelled towards the back bumper of a black cab. I brake just in time though, and a stern telling off is avoided. Day 3.
Another battle with the bike to wrestle it out the front door, but then a satisfying start to the ride. While sitting bolt upright like a granny on her way to the greengrocer's, I fly past a lycra-clad cyclist who looks geared up for the Tour de France. I'm sure he can tell I'm being aided by a motor, he might even detect its faint hum, but he still looks peeved. I duck onto the ring road around Regent's Park to test out turbo mode. I get up to 20 kilometres an hour without breaking a sweat. That evening, it's back to Bermondsey to return my moustache. All in all, a highly enjoyable experience, aside from the sheer heft of the thing. When they develop a lighter model, or perhaps when my gym membership comes through, I'll be sure to get my hands on one of these.
That was Monocle's Matt Alagaya. For more on the e-bike industry, pick up the November edition of Monocle magazine, available now. Finally, on today's show, over the past 70 years, Ferrari has grown from the passion project of an Italian racing driver, Enzo Ferrari, to become not only one of the world's greatest car manufacturers, but an indispensable luxury brand. Now, a new exhibition at London's Design Museum turns a spotlight on the company's success and the obsessive attention to the details of automotive design that has fueled it. To find out more, I spoke to Andrew Nahum, co-curator of Ferrari Under the Skin.
Enzo Ferrari had a very interesting life. He was a personage. He was determined to be someone. He thought, should he be an opera singer, a journalist, or a racing driver? And he'd seen races as a boy in Modena. In the First World War, he got very sick. His father died, his brother died. They may have caught pneumonia that was so lethal in 1918. It's not clear from the records. And he made his way to Turin to try and work in the motor industry. His father had a small engineering business employing about 30 people. Eventually, Ferrari got a job delivering chassis, running chassis to the bodymakers. Then he started a race. And eventually, he bought an Alfa Romeo and became very close to the team. Not long after that, he started to be involved in racing for them. And he had quite an impressive career as a racing driver. But he retreated from that by the 30s and became a member of the team, involved in team management, and he founded his own racing team as well, Scuderia Ferrari. So he switches in a way back and forth between Alfa Romeo and his own organisation.
And tell me a bit about the first car that he designs.
Well, he never made a car that bore the Prancing Horse badge and his name until 1947. So that's rather extraordinary. He's nearly 50. He's had a very busy and active career in motorsport, but he had this dream. So in the Second World War, he has a factory making industrial equipment, grinding machines for factory production. And even in the mid-war, you can see from the letterhead the way it changes. He starts to feature the automobile side on the letterhead and the print, and you can see he's thinking about cars. And in 1945, as the war had barely receded, he called one of his former associates in Alfa Romeo and discussed the design of the car, which would be the first Ferrari, the 125S.
And what kind of impact did that car make when it was released?
When Ferrari's first car was released, it was one of a number of new ideas, new cars. You know, Italy was recovering from the war. It was very creative. There was the Cisitalia in Turin, another new car. It had to prove itself. The first race it went into in Piacenza in 1947, it didn't do all that well. The next time it turned out at the what was called the Grand Prix of Rome, although it wasn't a fully international Grand Prix, it won. And it was gradually coming up and they were learning fast. By 1951, they won the Silverstone Grand Prix, the British Grand Prix at Silverstone, and that was their real breakthrough into top-flight international competition. So it was a learning curve, but a very compressed one. They didn't hang about.
And since then, obviously, Ferrari has gone from strength to strength, and its cars have become some of the most coveted in the world. And one of the reasons they're coveted isn't just because of their performance, but also because they are extraordinarily beautiful objects. There's a kind of aesthetic cult around them. I wonder, that very particular aesthetic, did it evolve purely from the quest for the fastest, best performing car? Or was there a deliberate attempt on the part of the company to make something that would be visually pleasing as well as high performance?
Italy had a marvellous culture for the creation of sporting bodywork and beautiful coachwork on special cars. This was an active business before the Second World War, and by 1938, the touring company in Milan were making extraordinary, streamlined, high-speed coupes for Le Mans, races like that. After the gap of the war, they came back to create something similar for Ferrari, but more compact, because the first Ferraris were quite small. They were 1.5-litre, 12-cylinder cars. In a way, touring picked up the best they'd done in the pre-war period. And then other coach builders, Bertone in Turin, but particularly Pininfarina in Turin, also started to build bodies for Ferrari. And by 1951, Enzo Ferrari decided he wanted to go with one company, and he chose Pininfarina, and they became, if you like, the design centre for Ferrari for many decades.
Let's talk a little bit about the exhibition at the Design Museum itself. What do you have on show there? And tell me a little bit about how you made the selection, what kind of story you hope it will tell.
The exhibition at the Design Museum is several things. Firstly, it's a look at Enzo Ferrari's life through extraordinary memorabilia from the Ronald Stern archive. So that charts his earlier businesses and so on, and his wish to make a car. We have the drawing of the first Ferrari drawn from 1945, the 125S, in Colombo's bedroom because he'd been laid off from work in Alfa Romeo and was working on the side, really, for Enzo Ferrari. So the archival side is extraordinary and has never seen before. The cars are a range of too many to list, but special, beautiful, with wonderful history and authenticity. Nearly all of them have achieved something extraordinary or had famous owners. For example, we have the first Ferrari that Gianni Agnelli, later head of Fiat, owned, the 1949 166mm Famiglia Emilia, and he wrote, "I will always remember my first Ferrari," and this is the car. But apart from that, we show the process of design, and we look under the skin, showing engineering components, arguing really that Ferrari starts from pure function to make a high-speed vehicle where nothing is compromised. So the layout of chassis, engine, suspension, weight balance are fixed by those objectives. The body has to clothe it as economically and as aerodynamically as possible. And to a great extent, that helps to make the beauty that you see, although there must also be artful decisions in there too. What I think we're doing is, that is particularly special, is showing design models in wood, in wire, and in modelling clay, the standard substance now for realising form in the auto industry. So really there is a history of car design, a microcosm of car design, embedded within the broader show on Ferrari history. And I think that's the first time these techniques have been exposed in a major public exhibition in Great Britain.
Andrew Nahum there, co-curator of Ferrari Under the Skin. The show opens at London's Design Museum next Wednesday and runs until the 15th of April. Next week, we meet a Singaporean design entrepreneur banking on bricks and mortar and eyeing up a space in London to promote bright young makers from Southeast Asia.
People can see that there is value in what they do. People can recognize that there is sustainability in pursuing things that they love to do. Then creativity can flourish.
Section D was produced by me, Henry Rees-Sheridan, Ben Ryland and Daphne Karnesis, and edited by Sarah Miles and George McDonough. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. Bye for now.